Good evening. We're going to be in Acts 19, Acts chapter 19, and we're going to be looking at verses 23 to 41. And in the recent, I guess, 5, 6, 7 years, it seems like, at least in the United States, there's been an increased amount of riots that you've probably seen on the news. I remember a few years ago, there was a sports team that won, and the city from which that sport team that won rioted. I don't get that one. But then there's also been cities that I think where their team has lost, and that city rioted also. There's certainly been rioting over racial kinds of issues, one of which happened in El Cajon not too long ago. I don't know, whenever you've seen some of those riots in the news, if you try to imagine what it would be like to be in the midst of that crowd, and maybe try to imagine what it would be like to be the person in the midst of all of that, that everybody wants to kill and is upset with. In Acts chapter 19, Paul is in that kind of situation. And in fact, he would later write about these instances in Acts 15:32. He says, "I fought with beasts at Ephesus." Some people have thought that that's perhaps a literal thing that Paul is saying here, because the gladiator battles were a real thing back then. Paul was a Roman citizen, though, and Roman citizens were not thrown literally to beasts. Paul is saying, in the context of this chapter on the resurrection, that I have fought with beasts, people that wanted to tear me to shreds. In 2 Corinthians, Paul opens up his letter by talking about this same event, by saying in 2 Corinthians 1:8-9, "For we do not want you to be unaware, brothers, of the affliction we experienced in Asia. For we were so utterly burdened beyond our strength that we despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death, but that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead." Notice what he's saying here. I experienced this affliction that was so bad that I despaired of life. And in fact, I thought that I had received the sentence of death. I thought that they were going to execute me on the spot. Have you ever had a time in your life where you were just despairing of life and you felt like you had received the sentence of death? It was in this moment for Paul that he actually learns to rely more on God and not on himself. Isn't that interesting for Paul to say that? The great apostle Paul had to still be trained through difficult circumstances. So that's what we're going to be looking at in this lesson tonight. Here's the map so we all know where we're at. Paul is in the city of Ephesus, and he's on his third evangelism trip. Every time he'd go on an evangelism trip, he'd always go further and further. And now he's in Ephesus, and he started in Antioch. That's his home church. And so this is an event that happens in the life of Paul in Acts 19. So let's go ahead and read verses 23 to 41. "About that time there arose no little disturbance concerning the way, for a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. There he gathered together with the workmen in similar trades and said, 'Men, you know from this business we have our wealth, and you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but almost all of Asia, that Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. And there is danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed of her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worship.' When they heard this, they were enraged and were crying out, 'Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!' So the city was filled with confusion, and they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, who were Paul's companions in travel. But when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples would not let him. And even some of the Asiarchs, who were friends of his, sent to him and were urging him not to venture into the theater. Now some cried out one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and most of them did not know why they had come together. Some of the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward, and Alexander, motioning with his hand, wanted to make a defense to the crowd. But they recognized that he was a Jew. For about 2 hours they all cried out with one voice, 'Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!' And when the town clerk had quieted the crowd, he said, 'Men of Athens, who is there that does not know that the city of Ephesus is temple keeper of the great Artemis, and that the sacred stone that fell from the sky? Seeing then that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash. For you have brought these men here who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. If therefore Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have a complaint against anyone, the courts are opened and there are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another. But if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly. For we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today, since there is no cause that we can give to justify this commotion. And when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly. If I was to tell you that what we're reading about in this text is a crazy church, what would you think about that? The idea of the word church, we oftentimes think of the word church as meaning a religious term. I'm going to church, and we always think about singing and worshiping God and everything like that. This riot, or this almost riot that we're reading about here, is described two times in this text as church, the same Greek word for church. In verse 32, this crowd of people that are assembled together, that are in confusion, are called a church or an assembly. In verse 41, when this assembly gets dismissed, it's called again, at least in the Greek, that's the same word for church. If you look at verse 39, when this town clerk comes on the scene, and he says, if you have anything further, settle it in the regular assembly. He's saying, settle that in the law court, in the meeting where people come together and determine things of that nature. This is a good text in a lot of ways, just to remind us that the word church means a group of people. That's all it means. It's not even inherently a religious term. When there's people at a football game cheering for the Chargers, but they can't really do that around here anyways anymore. But hypothetically, if the Chargers were still here, could that be called a church? Is it a group of people? Yep. In this text, that same Greek word is used to talk about a rioting group of people, which is why we have to specify by saying Church of Christ or Lutheran Church. It's just a plain word. So what we're seeing here is a riotous church of people. And we might have to ask the question, well, why are they clamoring? What's going on with these people? At surface level, this church, if I can use that term, is gathered together because there's something going on with their goddess Artemis or Diana. Diana is the Latin name. Artemis is the Greek term. This was the goddess of this time period in Asia. And we learn from this text, when this town clerk comes on the scene, that the place that this goddess was housed, her temple was in Ephesus. And here's a modern-day replica of it in Istanbul, Turkey. This was actually known for being one of the ancient seven wonders of the world or whatever. So it was supposed to be just a magnificent, beautiful kind of thing. And this building was used for the Roman banking system as well. It brought in a lot of revenue and wealth to specifically Ephesus. And this is the goddess that's in danger in this text. In verse 35, we learn why this goddess was even housed in this town. In verse 35, the town clerk explains that this sacred stone had fallen from the sky. Evidently, there was some kind of a meteorite that had fallen in Ephesus. And the people in Ephesus took it as this sign that the goddess is telling us that this is where we must take the temple. And perhaps the silversmiths that are going to be rioting in this text, perhaps they were making replicas of whatever that meteorite looked like that had fallen from the sky. I'm not sure everything that's going on with all of that, but that's probably what they did for their work. But notice that during this riot, well, first of all, let me say this. Luke is writing this gospel to most excellent Theophilus. He's addressed that way in Luke chapter 1. The book of Acts is written to the same guy. Most excellent would have been a term that would have been used for somebody that was in a Roman position of authority. And so one of the questions that you would have if you were Theophilus would be this. Wherever Christianity goes, there seems to be riots and problems. Is Christianity the problem? You ever seen that before, by the way? Somebody starts bringing up Jesus, and then people get offended and people get upset, and you start to wonder, well, is Christianity the problem? Is that the problem? Two times in this text, we're going to see that Paul is being rescued by the Romans, which to Theophilus would signify to him that Christianity was never the problem. Look at verse 31. In verse 31, during this riot, it says that there were Asiarchs that urged Paul to stay away from that scene. Well, who were the Asiarchs? This is actually something that a lot of archaeologists have found inscriptions of. There were these kinds of people in over 40 Asian cities. Well, what was an Asiarch? An Asiarch was somebody that was like a Roman or like a city officer, and they were in charge of setting motions and councils, like should we pass it or not pass it, and they'd pound the gavel, they'd do things like that. They would dedicate buildings, they organized festivals and games. So these people had important positions of authority in the towns. And notice that in verse 31, Paul had actually become friends with some of these people. But look also, starting around verse 35 to 41, the second time that Paul receives Roman help is from the town clerk. Now, when you think of the word clerk, you might think of like a janitor or something like that. But the town clerk in this time period had a very important job. He was like the chief executive officer of the city. This was actually the man that was a direct link to Rome, the capital of Rome. So this man in this city carries great amounts of authority. Now let's ask this question then. Why did this man even have to come on the scene? Why is this riot even happening? Do you remember earlier in Acts 19 where Paul has been preaching the gospel, the seven sons of Sceva tried to cast out the demons from the demon from this man and they fail at it, which causes people to extol the name that truly does cast out demons. And when people start to extol the name of Jesus, they start burning their books. People start walking away from the worship of Artemis, which would mean that there would be less and less people purchasing these little idols that people would have made. So there's a man in the city named Demetrius. And Demetrius, we could probably look at him like he's the guy that's in charge of the union or something like that. And he's been making all of these idols and fashioning them together, and he's got all of these people, and he somehow gives work to all of these folks, and he gathers them all together, and here's the ruins of what is the theater that they would have gathered in. It's been estimated that this thing could have housed about 24,000 people. So try to imagine this. You've got Demetrius, and he's whipping up this crowd, and let's say that there's 4,000 people that have entered already. And he says to all of these men, all of you make your wealth from this temple that we have in our city. And this man named Paul has been gallivanting all over the place saying that the things that are made from hands are not really God's. And this is how we make our wealth. Can you imagine all these blue-collar people in this theater gruffing and puffing and getting mad about the things that they're hearing? And as they say all of this kind of stuff, Demetrius continues to speak, and he holds up the flag of Artemis. He starts out with his concern about money, but then he sounds more patriotic, and he says that the great goddess Artemis, who everybody worships and everybody extols, she might start to get disrespected. Which causes these people in a great rage of fury to start saying, "Great is Artemis, great is Artemis." Why are they saying that? Because Artemis might not be so great. And sometimes people tend to pump something up that they're worried is starting to lose some of its prominence. And as all of this is happening, the city starts to hear, you can imagine people in the surrounding little areas here, they start to hear all these folks chanting and yelling and screaming, so it draws a crowd. There was a time when I was in high school, and there was a big crowd in the cafeteria, and everybody was clamoring and screaming, and I ran up to the crowd to see that there was a fight going on in the middle. Whenever there's a crowd, it tends to attract more people. So as all of these people are saying all of these things, you can imagine that the whole amphitheater gets filled with the 24,000 people, and they're all trying to figure out everything that's happening. In the midst of this whole situation, can you imagine being the Apostle Paul? You've been hearing this guy speak very emotionally about how great Artemis is, and you're the guy that the entire city thinks is guilty for this. And so Paul in this text is trying to get into the amphitheater. I try to imagine the kind of courage that Paul had. He wanted to take this as an evangelistic opportunity, I think. But this is when the Asiarchs say, "No, Paul, you're not going to go in." And also some Christians say, "No, you're not going to go in. They've already got two of your travel companions, and we don't know what they're going to do with them." And so Paul has to to restrain himself, and he actually listens to some of these people. And as all of this is happening, this has always been an interesting thing to me. The Jews send Alexander. Have you ever wondered why Alexander even shows up here? Alexander is this Jew, and it says in this text that he wants to make a defense. Well, what's he going to make a defense about? I think what Alexander wants to do is say to this crowd that the Jews are not associated with Christianity, so if you're going to put any blame on anybody, it's not going to be us, the Jews. It's got to be the Christians. You must understand there's a distinction between us two groups. And as soon as this man is getting to the center, try to imagine Alexander walking up right here, and he's about to speak, and maybe his Jewish tassels on his clothing gives it away that he's a Jew. And some of these silversmiths like look carefully at him and say, "He's a Jew! He's a Jew! Get him out of here!" They didn't think that there was a difference between Jews and Christians, evidently. And so they tell him to get out of the place. And they continue to clamor and scream for 2 hours, saying, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." I don't know if you've ever been to a football game before, but there are certain times where the crowd yells in unison. And then there's other times where people are yelling kind of their own things, and then it gets back into unison again. It seems like in unison for 2 hours. Great is Artemis, great is Artemis. Can you imagine if that's what we did for our songs? Great is God, great is God, great is God. And that was the only thing we sang the whole time. That's what these people are saying for 2 hours. And you start to wonder at this point, what's the town clerk up to for 2 hours? The town clerk shows up on the scene, and what he does kind of reminds me of mom or dad walking into a room with kids who are fighting. And he says to this entire group as it quiets down, "Everyone knows that Artemis is great. Why do you have to keep speaking these things that are so obvious to us?" If you've got anything to deal with these people, you have to go through the legal law courts to handle this situation. Everything else has to be handled in the regular assembly. But we're in trouble of causing a riot, not the Christians. And at these words, can you imagine what this crowd would have looked like as it started to leave the amphitheater? You got guys kind of like shrugging their shoulders a little bit, kind of feeling a little ashamed of how this town clerk had to tell them all to stop. You notice then that this riot begins with a speech from Demetrius, and it ends with this speech from the town clerk. Now, when you look at a scene like this, everything that's centered around this scene, or the scene centers around the concept of idolatry. Idolatry is a very prominent thing that we see going on, and there's multiple levels of understanding the idolatry here. But look at verse 26 again. In verse 26, when Demetrius is saying what Paul has been preaching, he gives us a summary of the things that Paul had been saying. In verse 26, the text reads, "And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all Asia, that this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that the gods made with hands are not gods." This is evidently what Paul was preaching when he went to different cities. We saw this in Acts 14. We saw it in Acts 17. Paul would walk into a city, and he would say, "The gods that are made with hands are not gods." I'm going to suggest that whenever we're trying to teach somebody the gospel, if we never bring up idolatry, we're probably not presenting it right. Because this little phrase is a way that everybody's kind of used as a catchphrase to understand that this is how Paul preached. This is what he was saying. He said it earlier in Lystra. He said it when he went to Athens. He says it when he goes wherever he goes, that the gods that are made with hands are not gods. Okay. Well, we're living in the 21st century, so we don't really have to talk about idolatry, right? In the ancient world, idols stood for something beyond themselves. In this text, all of these silversmiths, they love Artemis, but what do they really love? What Artemis gives them, which is the money, right? There's an idol behind the idol. Back then, sure, they had little statues that would kind of represent something, but the gods were always a means to an end of something that people in our culture today still want. We've just removed the statues. But there's always an idol behind an idol. So what is idolatry? Here's what idolatry is. It's taking anything made from man or deriving from man or that's in creation and putting it above God so that you need that thing to be happy, safe, to have your identity, to find your purpose and your meaning in life. Anything that's not God that you can't imagine living without, that you need for security, emotional comfort, whatever, if it's placed above God, it's called an idol. And by the way, this can even become a religious sort of thing, right? Like Christianized kind of thing. Where people start to say, well, I believe in God, I go to church and everything, but my God would never do X, Y, or Z. Well, now you've chiseled out with your own hands your own version of God. Look at what this text shows us about the power of idolatry. The power of idolatry in this text, and idols have power. Here's how they have power. It's seen in the riot. If you have something that you really like that's taken away from you, you're going to be sad and frustrated about it. But if somebody takes away your idol, you're going to start rioting about it. All of us in this room struggle with this idea of putting things above God. And there's certain people, and we all do this, where we can have a normal day, and then somebody touches our idol or steps on it or threatens to take it away. And we just freak out. Well, why were we okay the rest of the day until that thing was said, until that person upset me because I care about my honor and glory too much? Why was that the thing that set me off? Well, that's because it's my idol. And if you get close to my idol, then I'm going to defend my turf. The specific idol in this text was the money. In the book of Acts, have you thought about how much money has become a barrier to serving God? In Acts chapter 1, you have the story of Judas is retold and how he betrayed Jesus for some money. Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5. The men in the city of Philippi, when they had this woman that was demon-possessed and they were making money off of her and Paul cast out the demon, the men start to get upset at Paul because of what he does there. You see how powerful idolatry is over people? Here's what it does to people. Here's what it did to these silversmiths. They were enslaved to it. See, when we commit idolatry, we think, well, this is the thing that I need for ultimate meaning and purpose in life. God will kind of be an add-on, but this other thing is really the thing that means the most to me. And what ends up happening to you is you get enslaved to it. These men, when their idols start to get touched, are going livid. Because it's the only thing they think about. They can't imagine living without it. They're enslaved to it. Are you enslaved to anything tonight? Is there something in your life that you're thinking about and being more controlled about more than God? So that's the first way that the idols have power in people. It's seen in the riot, but here's a second thing. It's seen in the self-deception of the rioters. You notice what's happening here. In verse 27, they are talking about, just go ahead and read verse 27 again. And there is a danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed of her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worship. We noted earlier that the idol behind the idol is their personal well-being. But they're not saying it outright that way. They're saying, well, we really care about the honor of Artemis and the glory of Artemis, but the thing that we're really concerned about, if we were going to be completely honest, is our personal wealth. That's what we really care about. You know what you call that? You call that self-deception. The danger for you as an audience in hearing a sermon like this about idolatry is that if you're committing idolatry, it has the power over you to deceive yourself. So as I'm saying all of this stuff, you might not even be assessing the areas in your life where you might be committing idolatry. But here's how this self-deception works. Imagine that I'm like the silversmiths, and the thing that matters the most to me is money. Well, how do I speak about it? Well, I'm just being a good steward. And I'm just trying to figure out how to be a good steward in the eyes of God. That's what God has commanded. So that's how I'm going to talk about it. Well, what if my idol is my spouse and family? Can be a really good thing, but if it makes a really bad God. So here's how the people get self-deceived if your idol is your family or your spouse. Well, God cares about family, and God says that we've got to really be good husbands and good wives, and that's absolutely true, but they can't be your God. So quit trying to use those passages to justify your idolatry. What if your idol is health and your beauty? Well, 1 Corinthians 6 says that our body is a temple of God, and that has nothing to do with that context. You see how we can start to hijack things that sound good and righteous and say, well, this is what matters to me because by the way, God's okay with that too. And God actually wants me to support that. Yeah, you might be self-deceived though. Is it actually becoming more important to you than God? That's the power of idols. Is anybody here tonight in danger of rioting if somebody touches your idol? Is anybody here tonight deceiving yourself because of the way that you speak and hold up the banner of your false god? That's the power of idols. But here's the second point, the weakness of idols. This kind of sounds contradictory, doesn't it? Have you ever seen different passages in the Bible where on the one hand, when it talks about idolatry, it will say that idols are nothing, they're just things made from human hands. But then there's other passages that talk about how they're powerful. Okay, well, they're powerful over you. But ultimately, idols are weak because they can never deliver on the promises that you hope that they can. And we see this in the text. Well, how do we see this in the text? Notice how the idols are weak. In verse 27, the idols are weak because they're always dependent on circumstances. Idolatry is weak. It might have power over you, but it's weak because it's always depending on the circumstances. So try to imagine for a minute. Well, look at it in this text, actually. These people worshiped their wealth, and it was starting to be taken away. Their God was being stolen from them. If you take anything other than God and put it above God, did you know that it can probably be taken away from you? And that if you've been wrapping your meaning and your purpose in life around that thing that can be taken away from you, your heart's bound to be broken pretty soon. What if your God, for example, is some possession in your house? Well, what if somebody's in your house right now breaking into it and taking it? What if your idol is some political view and you really want this candidate to win and your candidate doesn't win, so I need counseling? Those things happen, and that's idolatry. Because I wrapped up my meaning and my purpose and my hope in something that lost. What if my idol is a person, and I crave their praise, and I crave the love that I want them to give me, and I've centered my life around this person? Well, what if they die? What if they cross you? What if they say something that you don't like? It's good to have relationships with people, but they make bad gods. Idols are weak because they're always dependent on circumstances that you have no control over. But here's the second reason why idols are weak, is because they're made from human hands. You ever wonder why so often in the Bible when it talks about idolatry, it says that these things were crafted with human hands. These things are made from human hands. Well, what's the point of that? I think the point is this, that even if you had the perfect circumstances, even if your idol was your sports team winning or something like that, and they finally won the Super Bowl, and you had the perfect circumstance, your idol is still from human hands, and it's never going to be anything divine in your life. It's never going to lift you up to the place where you think it's going to lift you up. Have we experienced this before in our lives, by the way? That maybe there's been something that you've put above God, and you had the enviable position. You had the big bank account. You had all the people who loved you. You had your sports team win. You had whatever it was, the perfect circumstance. How did you feel a year later? How did you feel the next day? You still knew that there was something missing because it's made from human hands and it never ultimately satisfies. What Paul says in verse 26, the summary of the idolatry that he gives about how it's made from human hands, is really similar to a famous passage in Isaiah 44. Look at Isaiah 44, verses 9 through 11. It says, "All who fashion idols are nothing, and the things they delight in do not profit. Their witnesses neither see nor know, that they may be put to shame. Who fashions a god or casts an idol that is profitable for nothing? Behold, all his companions shall be put to shame, and the craftsmen are only human. Let them all assemble, let them stand forth. They shall be terrified, they shall be put to shame together." You notice that when Isaiah, and this is a bigger section in Isaiah, it's like five or six chapters where Isaiah is talking about idolatry and the supremacy of God. And he's saying here, who is it that makes these idols that are profitable for nothing? You wrap up your self-esteem, your worth, your identity, your purpose in life around something other than God. And this text says that it's not going to ultimately profit you. You might be happy for a day or two, but it's never going to give you exactly what you want. So it becomes like a drug addiction. You're constantly needing more of that thing, and it's not paying off the way that you wanted it to anymore. But notice that when Isaiah 44 talks about this, he also says that these people are going to be put to shame. They're going to be put to shame. There's endless stories in our society that show that idolatry always leads to this. There's stories of people that were NFL players that depended on being athletic for their meaning and purpose in life. And then when their body gets too old where they can't play anymore, then they get depressed and upset because their idol was taken away from them. In this text, even, you've got these worshipers of Artemis. Where are the worshipers of Artemis today? Where are they? Haven't they been put to shame? Even a non-religious person can read this story and feel the shame of these people that put all of their stock in Artemis, who's not even worshipped today. Yet Paul, the man in the audience whose life was being threatened, Christianity is the thing that's still lasting today. So that's the weakness of idols. But notice, thirdly and finally, how the idols were confronted in this text. Okay, so maybe we're under the slavery of the idols. Maybe we know other people that are. How do we confront the idols? How does this work? And what's even the proof that the idols were confronted? Well, notice this fact, that the economy was influenced in the society or the city. This means that when these people were becoming Christians, they were having real life change where they didn't use their money the same way anymore. So much so that these people who made idols were losing out on business. There's one point just to make from that. If the gospel hasn't changed the way that you live practically, you might not have actually become a Christian yet. Or it might not actually be influencing you the way that it ought to. But notice that the economy was impacted. Try to imagine today. Let's say in San Diego, every single citizen of California became a Christian tomorrow. What would be some of the businesses that would close down? I suppose movie theaters would not show certain movies anymore. Maybe some hotels would go out of business because hospitality would be increased. There'd probably be a lot of restaurants that would close down. The idols were confronted in this society so much that it changed the landscape of everything. But notice how the idols were not confronted. Notice this first of all. Paul did not confront the idols in two ways. Town clerk that comes and he explains that these guys are not guilty of anything, and he kind of details out what they haven't done. In verse 37, they haven't been committing sacrilege. Your version might say that they haven't been stealing or robbing from temples. Here's what the town clerk is saying. You guys are rioting for no good reason, because these people that you want to execute, these people that you're mad at, they haven't gone to the temple forcefully and taken things from it. They haven't been tearing down the walls of the temple. They haven't been causing a ruckus in society. By the way, have some people tried to spread Christianity through those means? Somebody gets a message from God that they need to go blow up an abortion clinic? That doesn't do much for the cause. People think that they need to go destroy other nations in inquisitions and do all of these kinds of things in the Middle Ages and spread the false Christianity that they were propagating. You don't spread and confront the idolatry but with physical force. That's not how you do it. But you also don't do it through slandering. You say, well, I'm not going to use physical force, but I'm going to start picketing. And you didn't see Paul doing that either. He's not going before this great, ancient, one of the seven wonders of the world with giant signs saying, you're all going to go to hell because Artemis and Diana is a false god. Now, that's true that she was a false god, but Paul's not walking around obnoxiously saying all of those things. That's not how he confronted the idols. So here is how he confronted the idols. He's teaching one soul at a time. He's in the Hall of Tyrannus. In the siesta time of the day, like we talked about last week, the hottest part of the day, and there's people that are coming and listening to him preach and teach. And there's people that are listening to the message, and as Paul is reasoning with them, that your idolatry is vain and useless, and it will never give you what you want it to give you. As people were listening to those kinds of things, there were people that decided that Jesus has to be the rock and cornerstone of my life. And if he's really going to be the rock and cornerstone of my life, that means that I'm actually going to make demonstrable changes in my life. My life is going to look different because he's now my Lord. One soul at a time gets changed. How does this little meager church in San Diego affect people? Is it going to be through flyers? Is it going to be through giving tracts to everybody? Maybe some of those things might be helpful at times. But it's going to be through us and our spheres of influence reasoning with people about their idolatry and helping them realize that whatever they're trying to be fed by, if it's not God, it's going to be ashes. And that's not going to nourish you very much. Look at verses 18 and 19 of Acts 19. In this same chapter, you have all of these people coming and confessing and divulging their practices, and they burn their magic books, which are worth $5 million, like we looked at last week. On the one hand, you've got people in this society that are sacrificing to God, and you've got these people that are upset that their God is going to be destroyed, their false God. All of us in this room are either sacrificing to idols made with hands, or we're sacrificing to the true God. If you're sacrificing to the true God, that's where true life is found. If there's anything we can do for you tonight, if you need to turn from your vain idols and turn to the Lord who satisfies and fulfills our deepest longings, this is an opportunity to do that while we stand and while we sing.